This is Michael Gibbons appearing in Carson City, and I'm joined by Judges Jerry Tao and Bonnie Bullitt in Las Vegas. We're continuing oral arguments by video for a little bit longer. In June, we're going back to a full in-person argument. So you'll be one of the last ones that appear by video, so that'll be historical. All right, Judge Tao, would you like to say hello?
Good morning, everybody. It's good to see you. I guess this is the best we can do right now, but really appreciate your working with us this way. We've been doing these hearings for a few months now, and I know it's kind of annoying for everybody because you guys have to work with our IT guys and call in earlier, and it becomes like almost an all-morning thing just to do an argument. But it's the best we can do under the circumstances, and we really appreciate everybody working with us, and we're looking forward to your argument.
Thank you. And Judge Bola, and if you could remind them about our mask rules since the two of you are seated next to each other.
Good morning. It's nice to see everyone. Judge Tao and I are sitting together on the bench, so we do have our masks on. I know that might be a little difficult because you can't read our facial expressions. We'll do our very best not to interrupt you and apologize in advance if we do. Please let us know if you are unable to hear us for any reason, and we'll try to restate our questions. Again, thank you all so much for being here with us this morning.
Okay. All right, I'll officially call the case. It's 78957 COA and 79653 COA. This is Toya Foster versus Dr. Rudolph King, and it's the time set for the oral argument. We have counsel present for each side for the appellant, Mohammed Iqbal. Mr. Mohammed, did I say your name correctly?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And appearing for the respondent, John Cotton. It would be hard to mess up that one. So, Mr. Cotton's there, and I know you've had a lot of cases, appellate cases. You know, we see your name frequently, but oral argument's a different experience, of course, than just doing the written argument. This is a very interesting case, and so we thought we would set it for argument, and so we're really looking forward to hearing what both of you have to say today. All right, Mr. Iqbal, would you like to reserve some time for a rebuttal argument?
Yes, Your Honor. 3 minutes, if that's...
Okay, and you should be able to see the clock on one of the screens. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I can see it.
All right. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mohammed Iqbal, counsel for appellant Toya Foster with the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada. And speaking of historical, this is my very first appellate argument, so all of this seems very very standard to me. So I apologize in advance if I get any over exuberant here.
Just try to relax. It's easier than appearing in district court, and now that it's remote, it should be even simpler. But nonetheless, it's still nerve-wracking when it's your first one.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, Your Honor, you just mentioned simple. And here, this case does come down to a simple factual situation. The district court committed reversible error in granting respondents summary judgment because genuine issues of material fact abounded. The theory of the case, respondents' theory of the case, the very foundation on which their MSJ rested, that there was no transection, is contradicted by the documentary evidence, the contemporaneous medical records from respondents themselves. The MSJ should have ended there on that question of disputed material fact. The district court also committed reversible error, not just by failing to accept appellant's evidence and the reasonable inferences therefrom in the quote, light most favorable to appellant, but the court, in fact, ignored the evidence. Instead, the district court relied on respondents' conclusory and self-serving affidavits generated in March 2019 solely for the motion and after discovery, when these affidavits are contradicted by respondents' own July and August 2014 discharge and operational notes made contemporaneous with appellant's medical treatment. The factual situation we have here, as laid out in the briefs, it is very clear. It takes place over 57 days from June 12th, 2014, the initial surgery, with appellant being discharged on June 15th and having a considerable amount of pain, you know, given the OxyContin and the fentanyl that she was prescribed. And 48 hours later, she is back in the emergency room with a leaking leaking fluids, and showing the signs of and the collection of urine. The 57 days ends with the corrective surgery that she was in the hospital in Summerlin August 11th, and the actual corrective surgery, I believe, took place August 14th. Now, the records during these 57 days are very clear. All of the records, starting around July 3rd, speak to a transection. They speak to a transection, a cutting of the ureter, and the records speak to a transection. And in fact, there are no medical records to the opposite inference or the opposite conclusion that there was no transection. And in fact, in the surgery notes from August 14th, the notes state that there's a disconnected ureter. So we actually have here not just a minor transection or a simple cut, but we actually have a full frank through and through transection. And so on that basis alone, we have a genuine issue, a dispute of a material fact as to whether there was a transection. And for the district court to rely, one, on respondents' self-serving affidavits, but even more so, for the district court during oral argument to rely on distorted assertions of what plaintiff's expert actually said, is improper. And the inferences, the actual evidence, the district court not only failed to see the inferences in the light most positive to plaintiff, the district court apparently failed to acknowledge the bedrock evidence itself, which is that there was a transection. And the plaintiff's expert goes through this in the complaint, the affidavit attached to the complaint. There is an affidavit attached to the opposition to the motion for summary judgment. And when we look at the more than dozen hospital visits, when we look at the fact that every day, and the appellant testified to this, she made statements to this effect when she went to the doctor, that she was dealing with this every day, leaking bodily fluid, incredible amount of pain, and then the doctors, they did CAT scans showing a mass that should have told them that urine was collecting. There are references throughout the record, and when we look at the motion for summary judgment, what it did not do was attach, despite the fact that it had 15 exhibits, it did not attach medical records where respondents admit that there is a transection. The motion for summary judgment failed to attach medical records from July 1st to July 19th, 2014. So we're talking about one third of the time, the 57 days between the initial surgery and the corrective surgery. And here are the statements we have: party admissions, statements against the party's own interest. We have Dr. King himself admitting that there was a transection, that the surgery, and then in the post-surgery notes, We have a doctor who works with Mr. King admitting that the surgery was to correct the transected left ureter. And this caused an enormous amount of pain. The appellant was in a great deal of pain from the time that her surgery, initial surgery took place, all the way to the corrective surgery. And in fact, corrective surgery had to be delayed because of infections. And as plaintiff's expert also opined, when you have urine and it is leaking, that can lead to infections. And so the standard of care established by the plaintiff's expert was that when you transect the ureter, when you have a difficult case, you do not call in a urologist, when you do not use dye to see if there's leakage, when you do not make sure to protect the ureter, when you do not do these things, you have not met the standard of care. Now, the motion for summary judgment has a very truncated and narrow perspective on what exactly the standard of care was. The motion for summary judgment ignores quite a bit of the deposition from plaintiff's expert and states that the standard of care would only be violated if there was a full, a frank through and through transection and visible urine pooling. And that's not the standard. That's not what plaintiff's expert laid out in the exhibit attached to the complaint during his deposition testimony and throughout the documentary evidence. The respondents raised the issue that, well, Dr. Boothby, plaintiff's expert, he actually changed his mind. He actually agreed that there was no negligence. That's not true. Actually, when you look at the hearing transcript, which is in our appendix, TF310-311, and in the hearing transcript pages, page 28 and 29, respondents had to admit that he actually didn't change his opinion. Nonetheless, respondents insisted that it could be inferred that he changed sides because Dr. Boothby said he would change sides if the physicians assisting Dr. King testified in a certain way. And according to respondents, they did. They did not. Dr. Boothby's quote-unquote agreement was predicated on three factual conditions as laid out in our reply brief that were not met. These two physicians, they were not there. They did not conduct the surgery, and they did not state that the injuries were caused by something else. Now,
well, Mr. Iqbal, let me interrupt you. Isn't the reference to the surgery, the repair surgery, not the initial surgery? We know the surgeons who did the surgical repair were not present at the initial surgery. Wasn't Dr. Boothby really saying, you know, as long as those surgeons were there at the repair surgery, depending on what they may have seen, then he might have a different view of what occurred?
I believe, Your Honor, that the reasonable interpretation based on, and it, let me quote from Dr. Boothby's deposition, if they were there, if they did the surgery, and if they testified they did not think this was a transection, that it was another mechanism of injury that the doctor has no control over, I would change my opinion. So his agreement, Your Honor, is based on a number of conditions. And Your Honor points out one of the conditions in question. And even if we accept, Your Honor, that that one condition doesn't apply because Dr. Boothby was actually speaking of the corrective surgery and not the initial surgery, the other two conditions are also there, Your Honor. And the fact is that these very same doctors who claimed in subsequent affidavits and depositions that they could not tell their actual medical records from the time of the surgeries, the contemporaneous medical records, they admit that it was a transection. They admit that it was a transection going back to July 3rd. And if we're speaking of inferences, then the inferences should be drawn in appellant's favor as opposed to being completely ignored. At this point, looking at my time, unless there are any further questions.
Mr. Iqbal, really quickly, does the complaint in this case also envision an allegation of negligence for failure by Dr. King to inspect before he closed up the appellant's body? He does the surgery. Is he supposed to look for a transection? Is he supposed to look for urine or other fluid? Is that within the scope of the complaint?
It's a great question, Your Honor. It's not within the scope of the complaint. It is within the scope of the expert's report, and it is fleshed out during his deposition. But the breaches of the standard of care are the transection itself, and then given the difficulty. So is he supposed to look? He is supposed to look if it is a difficult hysterectomy, and all of the notes laid out by the Dr. King state that it was a difficult hysterectomy, and thus he should have looked.
All right, thank you.
And he could have performed a dye test, Mr. Iqbal. Is that what you indicated earlier to determine whether or not there had been an injury intraoperatively?
Yes, Your Honor. He could have performed a dye test. He could have had a urologist come in. And all of these things were not there in the initial notes. Magically, we have a self-serving affidavit that says the complete opposite of all the documentary evidence years and years and years after the actual medical procedures happen. And that is not enough for summary judgment. At best, what respondents have is disputed facts and disputed facts end the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Cotton, you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge. Since the early 2000s, the path from a claimed injury to allowing a professional negligence action to proceed to jury consideration can be equated to having the tumblers on an old safe fall into place. At any point the right combination is not input, the case fails and must be dismissed by the trial court. The case before this court is a perfect example of how the system is supposed to work. We look at the stages of litigation going forward on a professional negligence case. One, the injured party retains counsel who obtains a declaration from a health care provider critical of the treating physician. That's done here by Don Cutler, filing suit with an expert declaration. There's no requirement they have to use that expert to go forward in the case down the line. The initial tumbler's in place in this action. The next stage is the parties conduct discovery and then disclose actual trial experts opine as to the standard of care violations by the defendant physician. That was done here. Plaintiff designated Dr. Boothby on issues of liability. The next tumbler's in place, followed by depositions of expert and treating physicians. In my understanding, in this case, Mr. Kudler did not take any of the depositions of these parties. There's no, the facts that are developed during that process are not lawyer interpretations of them. They're what actually are testified to by medical care providers. In this instance, any references that are made in there to transection, there was never one question asked nor presented indicating that the transection they were talking about was through and through versus a nick or a cut on the ureter, which is significantly different. The people that are writing these things in the notes had nothing to do with the care of the patient. And unlike doctors Grigoriev and Robert Futeran, who went inside and actually operated on the patient, they're not opining as to them to contradict those two people's opinions.
Well, Mr. Cotton, let me interrupt you. Aren't they really saying they could not tell because several months had passed? They're not necessarily definitively saying that there was no transection of the left ureter.
No, and similarly, they're not saying that there was. If anything, Dr. Grigoriev indicated that the ureter was lying right in the line that it was supposed to be lying in. Dr. Futeran said that anybody saying this was transected would be speculative. So to the extent they want to go with speculative testimony, that's laid on the plaintiff at the same time. That's what they would be putting forward, an expert opinion based upon speculative opinion. You can't base it on...
Weren't there earlier tests, though, that would suggest that there might have been a transection to the ureter, or there was, in fact, a transection, even if it might not have been through and through, such as the failure to be able to place the stent in the ureter?
There's some discussion along that line, but the problem that they have is Dr. Boothby's opinions are narrowed by his own deposition responses. On our respondent, page 173 of the documents we've submitted to the court, there was a question asked of Dr. Boothby. It says, if there was a partial transaction versus a frank through-and-through transaction of the ureter, is it possible that any urine would not be visible in the operative field? Answer, yes. Okay, so are you only critical if it was a frank through-and-through transection that resulted in visible urine in the operative field? And his answer was yes. That right there, he does not have any factual testimony. All the uncontradicted testimony in this case indicates that they have not met the burden, his burden basically, that he imposed upon himself as an expert. They talk about the ureter inspection, and that they're supposed to, I think, Judge, you asked about the inspection, whether or not there was a before you close up inspection by these physicians, and both Dr. Lloyd and Dr. King went at length to explain that they did an inspection. Dr. Boothby, once again, they tried in an after-the-fact affidavit to indicate that nothing had been done because it wasn't written down. He changed his opinion on that, and where we designate him, again, asserting, question, well, assuming he did look at them, he just didn't document it, do you have any problem with that? I mean, if you assume he did attempt to locate them and did look at them, he just didn't happen to put it in his note. Answer, that happens all the time. I don't have a problem with that at all. So basically, their own expert is backtracking every time we get to the point of his opinions in this case. They can't really run from those opinions. They had opportunities under Rule 56. They had opportunities, if they chose to file an action, pleading with the court and say, hey, I think these guys are looking at this thing wrong, Judge. I want to go out and take a deposition, Dr. Grigoriev and Dr. Futeran again, and I want to get in more depth. They didn't do that. They had an opportunity. Nobody noticed any depositions of any of these healthcare providers after that to try to substantiate their position that we're misreading these prior depositions and misreading their under oath testimony, but there simply was not any such argument being made by anybody at any point in time.
Mr. Cotton, on a procedural point here, I see that Sean Kelly has joined us for the argument representing Well Health Medical. Do you want to allow any time for Mr. Kelly to also argue, or are you going to do the whole argument?
I think I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for Sean to give his opportunity here.
Is that sufficient, Mr. Kelly?
Yes, Your Honor, and I sincerely apologize for my connectivity issues, but that's totally fine with me. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead, Mr. Cotton.
And going on, again, with volume two of the respondent's appendix at 169, we've got the question posed to Dr. Boothby. Are you critical of Dr. King, assuming that he inspected the operative field thoroughly during and at the conclusion of the surgical procedure, which there's no evidence to contradict that, and looked for any spillage of urine and did not see any? I mean, assuming that was the case, would you be critical? Answer, assuming that was the case, I can't be critical because he didn't see. If there's nothing to see, there's nothing to see. And there isn't any evidence anywhere in the record to contradict that assumption, and it's a valid assumption put out there on the motion for summary judgment. If they felt that they had some opportunity to refute that or rebut that presumption, they could have done so. But once again, they chose not to do that.
Mr.
Positive motion practices. Go ahead. I'm so sorry.
Do you think the Williams case applies on alternative theories of causation here? Because doesn't Dr. Futeran And Dr. Grigoriev suggests that perhaps there may have been other reasons. I mean, the ureter, the left ureter, had to be repaired. There's no question about that. The question is, what was the cause of the problem? And you're indicating, of course, that there is no question of fact there, that the doctors didn't cause it, or your doctor didn't cause it. But the problem is, it had to be caused, or there had to be a reason that the repair was necessary. So do you think the Williams case on alternative theories of causation may apply in this particular case?
Judge, let me answer that backwards, if you will, to where you started. The first place here is the Williams case. Is my read of the Williams case is that is only to be utilized by defendants on causation issues. It doesn't extend itself out to a plaintiff that has the burden of proof. And so in this instance here, I don't think Williams would necessarily apply. In fact, I think it doesn't apply in this case because it's an attempt to be utilized by a plaintiff and not a defendant in this case.
You don't think you're utilizing it, sir, with the alternative theories that were discussed by the treating doctors?
No,
to
I don't
say
believe
it couldn't have been transaction, it was something else?
Well, here's the problem. When you take Futeran and Gregorio's testimony in this case, there's no evidence that anybody repaired a through-and-through transection of the ureter. That's what their expert said the negligence was. If it's a through-and-through and there's visible urine, you're committed malpractice. There is no evidence anybody repaired anything through and through. In fact, to the contrary, they indicated that it did not look like it was a through and through, and they couldn't opine without speculating as to what sort of an injury occurred. So it takes that bullet, if you will, out of the gun of Dr. Boothby, and he can't really substantiate his opinions under those circumstances. But I don't think that we're utilizing the Williams case because our position is the burden is on them to prove their case first, which we believe they did not with Dr. Boothby's admissions and multiple concessions that basically gutted his opinion. They did not meet that burden of proof. We would only shift our burden and move forward with the Williams-type argument if, in fact, they had met their burden and met the burden of expert testimony. They did not. And it's our opinion that having failed to do so, having failed to ask the trial court for leave to develop any additional testimony, that they waived that right, the court was perfectly appropriate in granting the motion for summary judgment and dismissing the case. And we would ask that this court do the same. I said 3 minutes, Judge, but I'm going to let Sean start talking now. I've said enough.
All right. Mr. Kelly, I apologize. I didn't realize you were going to be joining us or we would have waited for you in the first place.
No, Your Honor. It's our fault, and I'm actually glad you didn't because I didn't want to hold anything up. I think Mr. Cotton covered everything. I do just want to emphasize that the motion for summary judgment was filed after the close of discovery, and an appellant did have the option to seek that relief from the court to take these additional depositions and didn't. Additionally, appellant did not take the depositions of Dr. King or Dr. Lloyd, which is why their affidavits were required because there was no testimony from them. They were the only two that were in the initial surgery that could competently testify that they did not see any urine prior to closing the surgery. So that's the second point where Dr. Boothby basically stated he would have no criticisms if they did inspect and there was no urine. So with those affidavits, along with the testimony of Dr. Futeran and Dr. Grigoriev, plaintiffs, there's no genuine issue of material fact that plaintiffs don't have an expert that can support the allegations that they had in their complaint. And that's really all I have to offer right now, Your Honors, okay. Unless you have any questions.
Were you able to hear Mr. Iqbal's opening argument?
I caught half of it.
Okay. Well, this really quickly, he indicated there were two main issues, that the medical records indicated there was a transection. So he said that in and of itself creates a factual issue. And then second, that the affidavits were self-serving and really shouldn't have been used. So, you know, we've talked about the transection. If you want to say more about that, go ahead. But on the affidavit issue, I thought it was interesting that respondents brought this up. you know, the Dr. Boothby's affidavit is self-serving when it looks like that the affidavits that respondents submitted fall into the same category.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the transaction, again, I would piggyback on Ms. Cotton that there's no evidence that there was a true and true, through and through transaction. The records that indicate transaction don't say whether it's partial or a frank, and the only doctors that were involved in the repair, Drs. Fedoran, Dr. King, and Dr. Grigoriev, none of them say that it was a frank through and through transection. With respect to the affidavits, Dr. Boothby had his chance to be testify via reports and deposition. During his deposition, he stated what Mr. Cotton has already read into the record, that had Dr. Grigoriev and Dr. Fedoran testified that they did not see a frank transection, then he would not feel that Dr. King fell below the standard of care. He also testified that not seeing urine prior to closing up would also indicate that it wasn't a transection. The reason, as I just stated to your honors, for the affidavits of Dr. King and Dr. Lloyd is they weren't deposed in this case. They didn't have an opportunity to provide their testimony and what they saw. And it was important for this issue and the summary judgment motion to show that there was no genuine issue of material fact that neither one of them in the initial surgery saw any urine. So while appellant may feel it's self-serving, they hadn't had the opportunity to provide that testimony up until that point.
Okay. Mr. Kelly, isn't there still an issue of whether or not there's certain things that Dr. King should have undertaken to rule out any type of injury to the ureter during the hysterectomy, such as a dye test? Was there not indication for that because of the complicated nature of the surgery?
Well, thank you, Your Honor. I know that is one of the indications that Dr. Boothby does bring up. However, with the fact that Dr. Grigoriev said he did not feel or did not see that it was a frank transection, then he would change his opinion. So I think that takes out that dye issue with the testimony from Dr. Grigoriev, which Dr. Boothby was never provided with, up to and I think even following his deposition.
Now, Dr. Grigoriev was just the assistant surgeon. He did not have a separate operative note, correct?
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor. That for the repair surgery.
Correct. And did Dr. Fedoran, maybe I did he not say that you could still have a transection without necessarily seeing urine pool in the abdomen in his deposition?
That I can answer honestly, Your Honor. I don't recall if he said it or not.
All right. Mr. Cotton, do you want to try to answer that question?
No. I did want to comment on the affidavits. I mean, as a practical matter, all affidavits submitted are self-serving. The difference in the affidavit here from Dr. Boothby is the difference between self-serving and 180-degree turn on critical testimony that he gave about the observation of urine, and that's a big difference.
Okay. Mr. Cotton, did you challenge the affidavit, the second affidavit of Dr. Boothby below in front of the district court?
I don't know if it was challenged or not by counsel at that level.
Okay, thank you.
All right, that'll conclude the arguments for the respondents. The appellant will have 2 minutes to reply and rebuttal. 2 minutes.
Mr. Iqbal, you're muted.
Sorry, I apologize, Your Honor. Rookie mistake. So with 3 minutes and 57 seconds left on the clock, respondents summarized. But with the affidavits and the testimony, the motion should have been granted. We don't actually need to go there. We don't need to go to the affidavits. We don't need to go to the testimony, which is disputed and often contradictory between the different experts. And as counsel noted, self-serving. Let us go to the actual medical records. At TF226, this is July 25th. This is between the initial surgery and the corrective surgery. This is Dr. King. His notes indicate intraoperative transection. Quote, that's Dr. King. That's not an affidavit. That's not a deposition that somebody can train for or be prepped for. That's not a declaration attached to a motion that a lawyer may draft. This is the medical record. If you look at 223, 231, 234, 226, 228, you have a total of four or five physicians speaking of a transection. And respondents note that this transection issue has happened twice to Dr. Boothby. What they fail to mention to the court is that Dr. Boothby does about 400 of them a year and has been doing this for decades, and that it happened twice, and both times, even though one of them was a partial transection, there was urine visible. Bottom line, the standard of care that respondents set forth is not the actual standard of care. The standard of care as actually set forth by Dr. Boothby was not met. And that's from the medical records itself. Let's put the Monday morning quarterbacking aside, and let's look at the medical records from the time of the incident. And those, thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you, Mr. Iqbal. We thank all the attorneys for the excellent work on this case, a very important case. And Mr. Iqbal, particularly for your first argument, you have a lot to be proud of there. You made it, no problems other than muting, but that will never happen again because we won't be doing this anymore. So that's a very minor deviation. This case will be taken under submission for a written decision at a later point in time. Judge Tower, Judge Bullard, do you have anything further?
No, and thank you guys again. And as Judge Gibbons pointed out, hopefully this is the last time we have to do this. But I know, you know, probably, you know, put Mr. Kelly in a weird position where you only, you know, kind of came in late and missed part of the argument. Hopefully that didn't materially impact the substance of what you wanted to say. But, you know, those are the kinds of glitches that occasionally happen when we have to do hearings this way. But, hopefully this is the last one. And next time you have to argue, you'll be in person and won't have to miss anything.
Thank Mr. Iqbal, I believe that you took the case pro bono, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. Came through the Legal Aid Center, and we took it after counsel.
Well, we really appreciate all of our attorneys who take pro bono cases. It's so important to be able to give back to the community. And although you can't see my face underneath my mask, I am smiling. Oral argument by everyone was wonderful. Thank you so much for bearing with my questions and answering them. I greatly appreciate it. So thank you all for the very nice job.
Thank you, Aaron.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you all again.